One of the really fun ones was YouTube winning Next Big Thing. Like, I think they really called that one because we're coming up on the 20th birthday of YouTube. And then another one that I really liked was for cause marketing, KQED and NPR. We got the detail on that one. And that award was won for introducing their audiences to this new thing called podcasts. And what were podcasts about? And that was back in 2006.
Hello, and welcome to the Misadventures in Marketing podcast presented by the American Marketing Association San Francisco chapter. I'm Steve Haney, a fractional CMO in Silicon Valley.
And I'm Peter Farrago, a high-tech marketing executive in the Bay Area. Each week, Steve and I come together to discuss all things in high-tech marketing.
We share our own experiences running marketing teams with a special focus on technology startups, our successes, our failures, what worked and what didn't. We'll also be inviting our CMO friends and other marketing colleagues onto the show every once in a while and hopefully impart some wisdom along the way. Hey, Peter, what do we have here? It looks like a special guest star.
That's right. We have a very special episode. It's our first ever guest, Melissa. We'll get to Melissa in a second with the proper introduction. And the reason Melissa is the perfect guest today is because of the topic we're focused on. And that show title is called Drumroll. And the winner is, and this is really talking about the best way to use awards for your company, you know, pitching and applying for recognition for your company, the work you're doing, and how that can help also build a reputation and possibly even your marketing career. So Melissa is a great person to talk to about that. Melissa, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your marketing career, what you're focused on now, all that good stuff.
Sure. So I'm Melissa Grimshaw-Vargas, and I have a company called LaunchWise. I do product, brand, and company launches, and I also work in-house in strategic leadership with a lot of brands. So I've worked with Pete's Coffee, SC Johnson, consumer brands, as well as B2B, Bay Area, and global.
And like us, you're a volunteer with the AMA, San Francisco chapter, heading up partnerships, right? What's that about?
Yes, I rejoined AMA SF. I was a college member of the board back at Cal Poly. And so I recently joined the AMA SF chapter board as VP of partnerships. Has been a phenomenal few months, brand new in that role.
And I think your first major initiative is around awards, which again is a good reason for you to join us today. Tell us a little bit about this initiative, why it seemed exciting, and where we are in the process this year for the AMA San Francisco Excellence in Marketing Awards.
Well, these came out of two sort of sources. So we had Thomas Moyer, who serves on the board as well, who was looking to create something around awards that would be special to AMASF and the San Francisco Bay Area Silicon Valley community. And then we had our board president, Eric Widener, who did some deep dive research and uncovered our history of awards with the Excellence in Marketing Awards, which go back 40 plus years. Wow. And they dug through and found this rich history of winners and how, you know, all of these things came up. And so we were excited to bring that back.
Oh, that's amazing. Like, why do companies want to even apply to such things? Maybe how do they do it?
Well, I think, you know, when you mentioned awards in general, I think around building that credibility for our businesses and our names too. One of the things for marketers is we often hear about a brand being famous and that one of the goals for marketing is to make a brand famous. And so awards are a way to do that. Because when I think of somebody who's winning like Next Big Thing, I'm not thinking, oh, that their marketing is the next big thing. I'm thinking like, this is somebody that's going to matter in their industry or globally. And then even at a smaller level, if you're working with brands and maybe you're in the B2B space or you're working with companies that maybe aren't getting as much consumer knowledge, this is a way to build that credibility. Okay, maybe you're not a huge company or somebody that people know, but you have these awards and that helps to build that credibility in the field.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And just looking at this episode's topic more broadly recently, Peter and I did an episode on reference customers and talking about how especially a smaller company or an early stage company wants to get those big brand logos on their website and on their marketing materials because it validates them, right? It says, okay, Ford Motor Company or Apple Computer or Facebook or, you know, I don't know, Procter & Gamble, they've invested in these guys and taken them seriously. So you, as a prospect thinking of engaging with this company, can feel good about investing in them as well. This is the same kind of thing. We're all part of the AMA. We love what the organization does, but it's the fact that some of the most high-powered marketers in the world are part of this organization here in the Bay Area. We do business pretty darn well here in San Francisco, major gigantic corporations, and not just in tech, but across the whole spectrum of industries. And so when the AMA is handing out an award, that validates that company and their marketing efforts. I had a small software startup and we got accepted into a TechCrunch program. And just having that moniker next to us, and we had not even shipped yet. We had some investment, but those validators are kind of like those big logos. And when you have a group of professionals like the AMA or some other association, let's say a big publication like an Adweek, et cetera, that validates you as a company. And therefore, that elevates you to build out all those things that give you credibility so that when the sales guys are in front of a prospect or doing an ad, it's a huge, huge deal. And it's just another one of those validators. Peter, am I off here? Does that make sense?
No, I definitely think it makes sense. And I do find that it is industry specific. So if I think about run through some bigger media industries, so if you think about film and television, winning Academy Award or an Emmy for whether it's an ensemble or best writing or best directing or special effects or the actor, that actually becomes marketable in that industry for future projects, right? If you attach a major star and an Emma Stone, who's a 2-time Academy Award winner, then that builds credibility not only for her as a person practicing her craft, but her bankability and her ability to help a project get a return.
Can I interject one thought there? I don't think most people realize that all these entertainment industry award shows are just the marketing people promoting the movies. It's brand.
Yes.
That's what it is. That's a great, great point, Peter. And it's like, wouldn't it be great if the stuff we did, our products and services, got promoted like Hollywood's? And I know there's a certain glamour around it, and everybody's drawn into stories. So those kind of products, entertainment and storytelling products, have a certain resonance with the human heart that a piece of enterprise software may not. But still, wouldn't it be great if every year people got excited about the tech marketing awards and it was broadcast all over the world? Because you're right, Peter. It's no difference. They're a business, and those award it's a marketing program, right?
I actually got to go to the Emmys one year for my birthday as a C-filler, and it was very fun reason to dress up for birthday. But it is incredibly glamorous and all of that, and it is also incredibly a business, and they are there to build the marketing capabilities, the branding, and it, all of those things. They unlock new branding opportunities, but they also unlock lower cost marketing. Because if you can, for example, you are an Academy Award winning film, then suddenly in the section of whatever streaming service they're running on, there's going to be an Oscar winning category. And now suddenly your film is included in that. There's a reason, obviously, that Marvel films and all of that can get the budgets to keep going if everyone knows automatically, oh, it's Marvel. Okay, then we'll go. Or, oh, it's this big name. And then exactly to your point, those would be kind of your big name customers. But then if you don't have a big name customer and you don't have a big name IP, then okay, well, you're an award winner, And so then that goes the other way, because you, that alternate way into that credibility, that access, just opening those doors.
Yeah. I think that it depends on the industry. Some of the other media and entertainment awards, of course, I was thinking about were Grammys, Clio's for advertising, right? When I was in the video game industry, winning a Game of the Year, Studio of the Year award, or E3 award, a specific conference. Those were all really important and validating as part of the PR. The other part that is also exciting for people internally is it builds morale, right? That it helps the team feel like they're doing great work. It helps with recruiting. It helps the executive team feel like the company's going in the right direction. So it can be a momentum builder. It can be something that validates you, gets you above the noise level in an industry. I think about like G2, for example, for software. It's just like a major destination folks go. Now, they don't necessarily give awards, but you can kind of end up in a quadrant from that review site, similar to, say, Gartner. But all of it is different forms of validation and credibility and brand building. Now, of course, internally, you have to make this choice. You know, do I spend my team or my marketing time on applying for these kinds of awards? Will it make a difference to the business? Am I doing it more because I know we're applying and I could win and it looks good for my resume?
Right.
Maybe that's also worth doing. Maybe there's an intersection. When do you decide to apply for an award and sort of justify the work it requires?
It depends on what the objectives are of the company at the moment, right? So you mentioned several, but then also, are we going for another funding round? If we're looking for funding and we're getting these sort of industry acknowledgments, then that might be a priority that we want to spend a little energy on. And then also, if you're looking at acquisition or anything like that as well. But then, you know, it's the dichotomy or the you need to make the decision of sometimes award-winning content. When we talk about marketing, award-winning content isn't always the content that drives the business. So now I think we're getting a little bit better at evaluating our campaigns in terms of their impact and all of that as well. But I think historically, many of us have seen these just beautiful, breathtaking ads, and it's not really moving the needle. And so I think as marketing leaders, we also have to make that decision. Is that we're going to create campaigns that are really focused on something beautiful and incredible, or do we just need to, you know, drive those additional sales on D2C?
Yeah. And I think it depends. I mean, my general reflex is to apply to all of them, because once you have your spreadsheet with your standard responses and your content to upload, I wouldn't say it's a huge investment of time, but you do want to get bespoke with those submissions if it's like the Webby Awards or some very high level branded awards that, you know, are, you know, the cut above in whatever industry you're in and part of whatever you're doing, then you do want to spend extra time, and that can be burdensome on your team. So I'm going to share a quick story. I was at a company where we got into the Gartner Magic Quadrant. Usually what you do to kind of beat your chest and show off this pretty prestigious designation is you buy the report that Gartner wrote about your product, your software product, or you know, whatever it is that made the Magic Quadrant. And you put that PDF on the website to let them download it, because prospects, you know, there's a lot of valuable information in there, positive information about your product that can lead them to buy. And again, it's got Gartner's imprimatur on it, but that costs money. Right. They'll charge you $50,000-$75,000 for X amount of downloads for that, a PDF of that report. Well, I had a CEO who didn't find any value in that. He thought it made no sense for us to spend tens of thousands of dollars to get these reports from Gartner. And so we didn't do it. The point I'm trying to make is you really do want to make sure that with the CEO and the rest of the executive management team, that the value of this kind of thing is understood, so that when they see you making these investments, you know, it's going to pay off and be worth it. You know, we worked very long and hard, the analysts at Gartner, to get into the Magic Quadrant for this product in our company. I don't want to say it was wasted time. We could still mention it, you know, but it's one more tool in the salesperson's toolkit that they can, you know, put in front of a prospect and have something to talk about and have yet one more thing to start a conversation with. You just want to make sure it's going to be appreciated and pay off in a big way.
And that's a great point. I think on a consumer level, oftentimes, if you get into the beauty category, for example, there's Allure has, you know, their beauty winners, and then they do a sample box. So the theory is you're submitting for the award, you win the award, you know, you participate in the sample box, and then you're getting sort of full funnel activation. Then it's like, not only are you participating in the sample box, but then you also have an offer code for them to go purchase. So you're really trying to take this award-winning situation and turn it into something that's going to drive revenue.
Right. Yeah.
This episode of Misadventures in Marketing is brought to you by the American Marketing Association, San Francisco. AMASF is a member-run organization that has been serving the Bay Area marketing community for over 80 years. Through programs, events, workshops, and discussions that introduce the latest trends and developments in the industry, to networking events that bring together the best marketing minds in the region, AMASF diligently works to foster professional learning and career advancement opportunities for all of its members. Joining is easy. To become a member of AMASF, go to amasf.org. That's amasf.org, and click on Get Involved on the top menu, then become a member. For just $199 a year, you'll get access to events, resources, credentialed learning opportunities, and a community of fellow marketers who will help you expand your network and advance your career. The AMASF membership, the investment you make for the career you love.
Yeah, that drives exposure and trial. So exactly. It's more than just maybe a vanity award. I mean, I think that you need a story for a company, and awards can help you sharpen that story. And especially, you know, Steve and I talk a lot about startups. Sometimes the first few awards you win matter more than, say, the first 50 blog posts you do, right? Because they are a way to show proof early. And you need that credibility, as we've been mentioning. It can be hard to be ready to apply for an award. Sometimes you don't know if you're really even worthy, or you just got to kind of read the questions and give it a shot. There are ones that are a little more pay to play or a little more popularity contest. It's not like a judge of panels and peers, for example. It doesn't have the same process. I do think that most applications, it's best to be recognized by your peers credibly, but I do think that most of these awards you apply for do have some fee. There is some cost of managing in the background. I would be more wary of ones that have a very large fee that are kind of part of a partnership and feel pay to play. But I wouldn't be surprised if there is a fee at least to apply, because there are people who have to spend a lot of time in the background. So you do want to look at the criteria. You do want to kind of get a sense for how much credibility will it bring you and so forth. Melissa, I know that you were mentioning Eric found a lot of artifacts of past winners, and some of them have actually been really big names and brands in the history of the Bay Area. Yeah. And I thought it could be fun. I hope I'm not putting you on the spot. I think you've kind of been going through the time capsule few, but I thought it could be fun for us to like talk about a few of the ones that maybe you thought were interesting or surprising. And I'm sure Steve and I, who've worked for a long time, might even have a memory or an impression of that time and so forth.
Well, absolutely. I think Eric and his team did such a great deep dive to find all of this history of the Excellence in Marketing Awards, which I don't know if I even mentioned the name of the awards, but these are the Excellence in Marketing Awards, and they go back at least 40 years. And so with that, going through the Wayback Machine, Internet Archive, and some, I think, paper in binders for Eric, he really found brands that we all know. Apple won Marketer of the Year 3 times. I think we've heard of that one. And then we have all of these iconic Bay Area brands. So Levi's, Wells Fargo, Gap, which with Old Navy, Williams-Sonoma, Charles Schwab, just all of these great sort of old school, legendary, iconic Bay Area brands. And then sort of the migration into the web and the mobile and those brands as well. Google winning a Global Image Award, Yahoo Marketer of the Year in the 90s, and we had E-Trade. And then one of the really fun ones was YouTube winning Next Big Thing. Like, I think they really called that one because we're coming up on the 20th birthday of YouTube. And then another one that I really liked was for cause marketing, KQED and NPR. We got the detail on that one. And that award was won for introducing their audiences to this new thing called podcasts. and what were podcasts about? And that was back in 2006. And that's not the full list. There's so many great brands and names, and it spans really that sort of brick and mortar consumer brands up through, you know, tech hardware and mobile and apps and all that. So it's great.
Yeah. Well, I did a little research on some of the years. Let's talk about the YouTube one. I actually have a funny intersection. They won in 2007 for the next big thing, right?
Right.
Is that right? Yeah. They had just been acquired by Google the year before in 2006 for $1.65 billion. And that was now about 20 years ago. So that's a huge number. And of course, they became this cultural force and, one of the first really successful user-generated video platforms, and probably still among the most vital. But, you know, they redefined media distribution and creator-driven content. My personal story was I was at a startup, and I had somebody who worked, a classmate of mine from business school, I guess had like sent in a bunch of names of folks who'd gone to the same school, hoping to win some referral stuff, I think was what happened. Because, you know, basically I had Google reach out to me in like 2006, so the year before, or the year I guess they were acquired, in early 2006. And so then I interviewed with them, and I was interviewing with a group called Google Video. And Google Video, Susan Wojcicki was running it, the great Susan Wojcicki. And the woman I was talking to was like a product manager. And I happen to remember the details were really bizarre because she went to Harvard and had a biology degree. And I thought that was so like counterintuitive to like tech. But long story short is she was kind of drilling me. This person was drilling me. I remember feeling the stress a little bit in the interview. She was drilling me a little bit about, how do we make Google Video win and this and that. And I basically blurted out, maybe not my finest interview, but I basically said, oh, you're not going to win against YouTube. Like, and then she was starting to say, yes, but they're going to have licensing problems, you know, like their stuff is like pulling from all over the place, and there's going to be all kinds of legal stuff. And I said, that's not a problem. Like, what they have is buzz and momentum and consumer engagement. And by the time the government catches up with that, it's going to be 5 to 10 years, and you guys will be wondering how you lost. And she's like, you know, blah, 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 what should we do? And I said, honestly, you should acquire them.
Oh, how funny.
And then I laughed, and I basically realized I shit the bed in my interview, and that was the end of it. Because her like legacy project she was kicking off for Susan. And then within a few months, the headlines, Google acquires YouTube. And in my head, I was like, I told you so. I told you so. That's probably a good example also as an aside of whether it's better to be right or effective in one's career. Right. So I was right, but I was not effective. Basically, I basically had a terrible interview if you look at it like just by the numbers. But well, I was right.
But you know, it's interesting because the general adage is that all acquisitions are bad, and that they all go south. Nothing could be more the opposite than Google buying YouTube. And you know what? I sincerely believe that YouTube would be gone if they had not gotten acquired by Google, because everything Google brought to that platform has just made it the magic it is today. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, and it's another great topic, which is which companies do a good job of buying and integrating acquisitions, because I can tell you, for example, Yahoo is on the other end of that spectrum. Whatever it buys, it like hugs to death. Google, I think, knows how to leave them alone. Yeah. So you guys want to talk about another one? What's one that is exciting to you, Melissa?
Well, one that I just loved from the consumer side of things, Old Navy won for the year. I was totally nerdy, and I watched all of these clips. They had big pocket jeans. They were selling big pocket jeans in their ads, and they're intentionally campy. They're so fun. They're so just silly. And at the same time, these jeans are also kind of silly. You know, we're like in these giant jeans with giant pockets that were super popular at that time, and now, of course, are popular again. I personally love that style of jeans, but just like it just made me laugh. Like, but at the same time, because of who they were at that time, they're able to play and have so many different activations. Levi's also has a big reputation for these very cinematic ads. So they had, you know, the year that they won Market of the Year, it's like David Fincher, and, you know, just really creating really cinematic content. And then, of course, you know, obviously, if you get into the the era of when we're early stage, our first internet winner, I think, was Yahoo. If you can't still hear that logo, like I can hear that yodel.
The yodel, yeah.
For the rest of my life. It's locked in. So I think from a marketer of the year perspective, like that one in particular nailed it.
Yeah, and that was 99, so that was the peak of the internet, and they were able to do something quirky. I do want to say about Levi's and Old Navy. Old Navy is a fascinating one to me. I'll start with that. Old Navy, if people don't know, is part of the Gap set of the Gap company, and Gap has kind of three tiers. They segment their audience and have three different brands and retail store chains that go after them. So Banana Republic's on the higher end, and the Gap is in the middle. And Old Navy was their sort of lower price value kind of push. And so what I think was so effective about that campaign, because I remember it, is first of all, with that price point, they're going to appeal more to youth, I think, right?
Yeah.
And it was the beginning of fast fashion. We now know what fast fashion is. Mm-hmm. But back then, it wasn't a thing. And I think what was great about television back then, the audience was so big, and the amount of money and creativity that was spent on these campaigns and the ability for them to change perception or shape perception for a brand and just get played everywhere was amazing. And so I remember the formula of the Gap, a lot of humor. Often they'd have one quirky kind of person that was almost a recurring character, or someone who's somewhat famous, maybe a B-type actor who's very quirky and recognizable. And they would pick one hero item. You know, they had a vest one year, you know, soft puffy vests, and they would run the heck out of that everywhere. And that was really cool. I'll just say about Levi's, I worked at the ad agency when I was an undergrad. I worked at Foot Cone and Belding at the time. It's now just Foot Cone. And we were at Levi Strauss Plaza, and Levi's was a major client. We had a lot of interaction with them. But the thing that I remember that's burned in my head about these cinematic styles of commercials, it's memorable for anybody from this era, but it was like a very kind of like tumbleweed, dust bowl scene, and this car,
yeah,
this huge Cadillac, convertible Cadillac. It's almost like very sepia, and it's like coming from the distance. There's a little billowing smoke behind the car, and it's coming toward this little bit of a rundown shack or house, and there's this very attractive young woman who's leaning back on the porch or whatever. And so it's all this storyline, and we don't know anything about it because it's just this kind of cold open of a weird commercial, and it's Levi's. And at the end, she stands up and just says, "Travis, you're a year too late." And the commercial ends. Like when you were talking about Levi's, I was like, yeah, Travis, you're too late. And I still don't know why. You know, probably maybe unrequited love or something. So they would tell these stories and snippets to get people's attention. It was a very high art form.
Totally. I remember another ad. So there is an ad that I watched that I think it was a different one than this one, but it might've been part of that series. The whole premise and the whole plot built up to revealing the coin pocket. And I won't share any more about it, but it was the purpose of the coin pocket. So that was
ad.
Yeah. So then another ad that I actually remember from childhood was, in Prague, you could trade them for a car, you know? And so
as
a kid, like, that locked in my brain. I'm like, I guess in Prague, if I need a car, I should just take some Levi's jeans with me.
it's actually strangely true. So my parents come from Hungary, and Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia back then, where Prague is the capital, is bordering it to the north. And that was all part of the greater Eastern Bloc. And so my parents, who were Hungarian and came when they were young adults, were always sending money back home to friends or to family members. And then when we would go visit, we would bring Levi's, Levi's,
right,
and also really good ground coffee. They could not get good ground coffee there for some reason, and certain chocolates. You would know to bring certain things that they just could not get. And Levi's really just stood for America and had a whole Americana spirit to it. It's quite amazing. Yeah, the power Levi's had.
Iconic.
In terms of the brand. Yeah. Yes, that's a good word.
So, Melissa, you're relaunching this amazing awards program, the Excellence in Marketing Awards. Tell us about that. What does the relaunch look like? What kind of work are you doing? Maybe some dates, website resources.
The awards themselves will be July 24th. And the deadline to submit is May 29th. And normally, to your point around submitting for awards and the costs and everything, normally these are, you know, $100 or more to submit to these awards. And so it was really important for us to waive any fees this year. So it's completely free. That was an initiative to celebrate the industry and give a little boost and a little lift to the community, because we've had a challenging year. There's been, you know, obviously people have gone through layoffs. There's just been a lot going on. And so this is an opportunity that's like, hey, it costs you literally nothing except for your time. So people can submit through May 29th. Finalists will be announced June 25th. And then the awards are going to be sort of an outdoor festival vibe on July 24th. And that is
the
difference.
Cool.
Yeah. So originally what we found of these awards was that they were very sort of glamorous and sophisticated and, you know, at Le Méridien Hotel and the awards themselves looked almost like something out of the Golden Globes to your earlier point. So this is going to be different. And again, we just really wanted to take the opportunity to invite all types of brands and startups and bigger companies, et cetera. And thinking of startups in particular, the one new award that we added was bootstrapped campaigns. And obviously, we know we're going to have these bigger companies will be able to participate. But for brands who don't have that kind of, you know, creative team and budget and all of that, we did bootstrapped campaigns. So thinking primarily of startups, but also small food brands, you know, CPG brands, mom and pop shops, like cafes, whatever it is that can also participate. And you don't have to be the size of a tech giant.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website. If you go to amasf.org, so for American Marketing Association San Francisco, amasf.org, you'll find an easy link to the page. And I'm looking, the application is not very demanding. And it has, to your point, a good variety of things for bigger and smaller companies. So there's Best in Show, there's Cause Marketing and Community Enrichment. So if you're not in tech or have big budgets for TV, those are some most innovative marketing campaign, right? I think a lot of stuff is digital today. And I think that if you can drive, say, virality, Agency of the Year is a more standard one for people who do that high level of work. It's an opportunity for them. Marketer of the Year could be anybody. The next big thing is probably really about innovation and something breaking out. Your bootstrap campaign of the year, I love. I'm at a startup. Every little startup has no money. And then student achievement, I think it's worth calling out. If you're a student, you know, and just thinking about marketing, there's an opportunity for you as well. So I think those are cool. You mentioned Apple won three times, and this is a good contrast to the fact that we have a lot of awards that are possible for lots of different people to apply to.
I was coming up in the publishing world in New York, I discovered this computer called the Macintosh. And I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to work for this company on the West Coast. I just got to figure out my path to get there. But part of all that was the creative, because even before Steve Jobs came back, Apple always had wonderful creative. It was in that Garamond font, and everything was a bit whimsical and fun. And there were a lot of puns and sarcasm in the way they delivered it. I was there in the dark days. And one of the reasons I left in 95 is because things were getting very, very, very dark. Mm. But that whole period when I was there from, you know, basically 90 to 95, it was the creative that drew me into the company. And I had the fortunate experience of working with the creative services team inside Apple. And it was still, even during those not so great days, there was the spirit there, the vitality there. And I just produced some really wonderful ads with those guys back then. I'm dating myself here. Looking at me didn't give it away already, but we did newspaper ads, right? Working with our resellers and retailers for various verticals. I was focusing mainly on school newspapers and programs and materials in the university retailers. We did very specific creative that came out of the brand book, right? So we still had to stick to the same themes. And it was just great stuff. And it's funny because just a few weeks ago, I was cleaning out the garage and I was just looking at, I'm not exaggerating, you could put a warehouse wall up of all the creative and my team did over the period of 5 years, just a ton of stuff. I mean, it was all fantastic. So it was that spirit that was planted in the company that created the brand that led to this fun, light, interesting creative, yet at the same time sold product. and got through the customer value to get people to separate them from their money and buy a computer or whatever else we were selling at the time.
This episode of Misadventures in Marketing is brought to you by Peakbound Studio, the Bay Area video production house for high-impact marketing videos. Online video is quickly becoming the universal language of business and the primary medium through which marketers speak to their prospects. According to Forbes and market research firm Statista, 90% of all businesses are currently using online video in their marketing. And in 2025, 85% of those businesses will increase their spending in online video over last year. Enter Peakbound Studio. Peakbound Studio is not just another video production team. They are storytellers, visual artists, and high-tech experts rolled into one. They manage everything from the initial concept to the final edit. Your online video presence has to be responsive, vibrant, and constant to get the attention of prospects and spread your message into every corner of the marketplace. Peakbound makes sure your messages are unique, compelling, and pop in today's attention-scarce world. So whether you need brand storytelling, customer testimonials, corporate videos, or short-form social media content, Peakbound delivers videos that don't just look good, they work. Learn more at www.peakbound.studio. That's www.peakbound.studio. Peakbound Studio, the video production house that puts your online video to work.
Well, and there were so many opportunities like that when I was looking at the Apple stuff in particular and the products, to your point around going to all these different product lines. And I was like, okay, the first laptop, you know, happening at that time, even though it looked like it was produced by another company, but on Mac OS. And so just those fun things, like looking back, not only from a marketing trajectory perspective, but then also the product perspective. Yeah. So it's like, it's not just that the products that we're selling and the brands that we're looking at, it's not just that they've changed, but also how we go to market has changed so much. I don't remember doing a newspaper ad, but I did do a phone booth ad for trade shows. I think they literally just still have phone booths in some spots
outdoor.
Of New York.
Yeah,
just outdoor. Because they sell ads there. So.
Well, you know, but even as recently as, I don't know, just a few years ago, you know, as VP of marketing at a software company, and our market in Japan, they still do CD-ROMs in the mail.
Oh, wow.
Right. I mean, in a lot of different cultures and different countries, they're not like the U.S. where everything has pretty much gone digital and it's what's on your phone screen that matters. If you're managing a global marketing organization, all the practices are different in other countries. They have different practices. I don't want to say they haven't come along the way we have, because I would not. I don't necessarily feel that we always do marketing right in the sense of the best ways to reach a customer. I think there are ways that were used before that can still be incredibly effective. I still carry around business cards because nobody hands out their business cards anymore. But guess whose awareness after a cocktail party or an industry mixer gets noted? Mine, because I'm the only person with a business card that's, you know, sitting on somebody's desk, unless they pitch it, which I'm sure many do, but many don't. My point being is that a lot of markets are still using other mediums that aren't all digital, but certainly here in North America, I'm not sure that there's anything beyond, you know, what goes on the phone screen and maybe a laptop screen.
Echoing what you guys are saying, really just adding to that, is that marketing has changed so much in the way we go to market and the assets we're delivering. But underneath all of it, it's reminding me, it's almost a little bit of a lost art. I'm having this almost nostalgic moment for old Hollywood in my mind here. The job of marketing that gets overlooked a lot is, you know, that we're trying to capture people's imagination. We're trying to move them. We're trying to create an emotional response. And the vehicles that we had at our disposal, you know, the physical things, big budget broadcast TV style stuff, that allowed us, I think that gave us different ways of doing it more easily. If you can still deliver that today, I think you have an advantage. I do a lot of copywriting. I'll just give people a couple tips. Like you mentioned Garamond font and whimsical and clever for Apple, for example. Alliteration is your friend. You know, getting good rhythm and alliteration. Double entendre is usually your best friend. If you can have something mean two different things, depending on how you think about it, that ad copy lands much better because people read it one way. And then when it sinks in, how it's also, you know, interpreted a different way that's also interesting and appropriate, then they start to get the cleverness and the depth of it. So people who can work with a few words and capture attention and deliver those types of things, whether it's through alliteration, double entendre, being clever, some well-placed humor, those people can still win in a digital world where it's just a lot of ads. And that's where I think, Melissa, you do brand work. And I wonder, like, if a lot of what you talk about with clients is starting with that story, that narrative, the set of values, what you want to convey, the emotion you want to charge someone up, some audience, a recipient up with, right?
So a lot of my field is in, you know, digital and e-com in particular, and we have to think through, to your point, around the emotional cues of everything we do. So in terms of the platforms, it could be anything from, you know, TikTok campaign. You could be working with a bunch of creators, which, by the way, also changes how we pay for things, because sometimes you can do campaigns now where you can really budget it from an affiliate perspective. So you're only paying for the product that's sold, and that can unlock some opportunities that you wouldn't have if you had to just pay out of pocket for all of that content. And when you're working with these different mediums and different platforms, and if it's social commerce or all these other ways of getting to the card or getting to the loyalty or whatever you're trying to achieve, this is another great way to think about sometimes beautiful work doesn't always achieve the business objective. Because a few years ago, I was looking at a campaign where it was really provoking and really thoughtful on a certain topic. But in e-commerce, it was a very negative emotion campaign. So from an e-commerce perspective, it's just not the right place. So if we want to talk about that sort of campaign, that sort of thing that we're really passionate about, absolutely, let's do it, but in a different space, a different vehicle. Because when I get to the end of this ad, if I haven't already turned off my entire computer, is that I don't want to hit the buy now button, right? So I want to do work that makes someone hit buy now, or I want to do work that's going to get them to subscribe or loyalty or whatever. And then that can take any form from color theory, understanding how colors make us feel from a digital perspective. If you have people whose faces are smiling at the camera, you're going to get more likability and all that good stuff. So there is a ton of human behavior, consumer behavior types of things that we do want to understand, and we don't want to kind of violate that. You know, we don't want to make somebody feel uncomfortable watching any of our content. And then also, even in a B2B space, I think that sometimes we forget that you're still dealing with a human at the other end of that. So when you think through just this, just like we mentioned with awards, if you think through your target buyer and what they want and need and all of that from a B2B perspective as well, you're looking at their career. What do they want? What do they need for their next promotion? And what fears and insecurities do they have? So it's the same kind of human understanding. And we just also have to apply it in different forms.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the medium is the message, you know, how you're being context aware. And for people who are thinking about awards here, you know, awards aren't just about the campaign. They are the campaign. They tell a story before anyone reads the case study. And so getting that recognition can change the value of the work. And sometimes it's really understand it. So I think that's good motivation to try to capture that moment if you feel like you've done good work and made impact. And even just this little riff was reminding me about how many things we take into consideration. We've all been doing it for a while, but there's hundreds of little decisions we're making all the time. Some of them are rules of thumb, and some of it has to do with the context and, okay, well, this is going to be shown here, and you know, this is the experience we want to give someone there, but it's maybe not appropriate there. So it's not just a one size fits all. It's not a one and done with a campaign. You have to really modify it at the edges as well. So a lot can go into it. It's intricate work.
Absolutely.
That's probably a good place to wrap up, don't you think, Peter?
It feels good. Yeah, it feels like a great place to wrap up. Melissa, thank you.
Again, thank you.
Your perspective has been amazing, and the work you're doing with the AMA and reviving, I think, which is a great opportunity for people in the Bay Area and a great tradition. I'm really excited about it.
AMASF.org. And then if you, there'll be a link there to the awards page, but it's also AMASF.org/EIMA, Excellence in Marketing Awards.
That's fantastic. Right. And if you miss the deadline for some reason this year, by the time you hear this episode, don't fret. I mean, because it's an annual thing, and start thinking about the next year, and maybe the application will be that much easier. But again, thank you, Melissa. This has been amazing. Tell us your agency again one more time, just so folks know.
Oh, my company is called LaunchWise, and I do product, brand, and company launches, and I do in-house executive leadership or brands.
All right. And is there like a website or something people can go to learn more, or how do they find out more about your...
Sure. LaunchWise.co. And, or if you want to learn more about what we're doing with AMASF, then you can also go to AMASF.org.
Okay. So LaunchWise.co. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you again. And Steve, do you want to do us the honors and read us out?
Thanks to our audience, of course, for listening. Our editor, Lorenzo Fernandez-Kopek at Peakbound Studio, for making us sound and look great. Our marketing manager, Ian Robinson Lambert, for getting the word out. Ariana Azevedo for our brand graphics. And of course, Eric Widener, president of AMA San Francisco, for presenting this podcast.